Prepare today with Owen Beatty.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, you're welcome back to the show. Now, as you will have heard on our news bulletins last week, that Kenneth O'Reilly, convicted in 1997 of the murder a year earlier of Milltown woman Joyce Quinn, is to remain in jail. KFM learned last week that Joyce Quinn's family were officially informed last week that the killer's application for parole has been refused. Well, I'm joined in studio now by Ray Quinn, Joyce's husband, and just to mark from the outset that we will be going through some of the details in relation to what happened to Joyce that some listeners might find distressing. Ray, thanks for coming in to us this morning and good morning to you.
Good morning, Keane.
So let's look back at what happened in Milltown outside the shop when Joyce was killed. Take us back to that day.
Well, on that evening, I had called to the shop around 6:30 and collected my youngest daughter just said farewell to Joyce, something inane like, I'll see you soon. She was due to close the shop at 7:00. I headed at home with my youngest daughter, Lisa, and then time went by at home. Joyce hadn't appeared. So I went back out along the road looking for her, thinking she might just have had a puncture or something. There was no sign. I went back home again, fully expecting that she would be there, that I might have missed her on the road, but she wasn't. So with my son, we went looking. I did report her into the Gardaí that there was something very strange had happened, because Joyce would not be the sort of person that would divert, you know. Mm. She had already placed a meal in the oven for timed to come on, so we would have dinner. We searched around different areas around Pollerstown Fen, all the rest, and then my son David found her car at the back of the school in Milltown, and the poor child just he was like the only way to describe him, he was like a wounded animal. He just wailed and wailed and wailed. He was inconsolable, and of course he saw the car with the bloodstains on the seats. Then after that the Gardaí swung into action, and it was a search organised for the following morning with the local community, soldiers from the Curragh, and of course the Gardaí. And Joyce was found relatively early in the morning, around 10 o'clock.
That evening, was that unusual that Joyce wasn't home at that time? Or did you immediately become concerned?
No, I became concerned immediately because, like, when I went into the Gardaí, the guard on duty said, well, look, I mean, it's only an hour and a half or so. Maybe she met someone and went for a drink. And I said, that is absolutely impossible. Joyce would not do that. Mm. I mean, I'd be the first to admit it. I would.
Yeah.
You know, but she wouldn't.
Yeah.
Not a chance on earth with her family waiting for her or anything else. So I knew there was something really badly up at the time. I had bought her a mobile phone a short while before that, but we couldn't get through on it. And of course, that was subsequently found in the cistern of the toilet in the Hangman's Arch pub in Milltown, where the perpetrator had put it.
Really? And again, at that time, you know, you mentioned that you'd bought the mobile phone, but we're still at a time where communication is not really, you know, that easy to, whereas nowadays you could just send a text or a WhatsApp and say, I'm heading here, heading there, whatever.
Correct. Yeah, mobile phones were relatively new at the time, mm-hmm. You know, but I would be sort of, I suppose, because of my army job, my overseas service, and I was actually working with the Gardaí at the time. I was the liaison officer between the Gardaí and the Defence Forces. So I would be conscious of security, and that's why I bought it for her. I mean, she took it with a smile just to humour me, but she didn't think it was necessary.
So the car is found at the school in Milltown. Your son finds it. The next step then is what?
The next step, the Gardaí came on the scene, and that part was sealed off because the young guard on duty was very switched on, excellent. He said, this is a crime scene. Immediately. Now, we were still hoping, of course, that Joyce might have been abducted or taken away. It was a frightfully cold night. So we searched outhouses, other buildings, all the rest. We called her family, extended family, friends. And we spent the night searching for her. In fact, we went by the Curragh very close to within about 30 metres of where her body was actually found the following morning. But we missed it.
You mentioned how cold it is. It was a January, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a bitterly cold night, bitter cold wind. And of course, her funeral was absolutely surreal because... The snow started, quite a heavy snowstorm started. And what I do recall is, you know, driving out to the cemetery, and I looked out there, my army colleagues and Gardaí were marching behind. And they were like snowmen. You know, her grave was covered in snow in a very short time.
It's, even listening to it, it's surreal. And I mean, some of the things that you say, that you're hoping that she was abducted, or you're hoping that there's still something to hold on for, that she was still alive. When you're out looking over the course of that night, what's going through your head, or what are you thinking you might come across?
Well, I suppose obviously we were hoping that we would come across Joyce, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe tied up, abducted, just robbed or something like that. Anything like that we could live with. In fact, the following morning, an RTE crew came down to do an interview with, you know, the usual things, unfortunately, that happens to victims like us, where people appeal for information and to, you know, just release their loved one. But just as they were sort of pulling in the gate, the Gardaí arrived to tell me that they'd found a body. And the Garda officer, a very experienced officer, he became quite emotional about it, because he said that no matter how hard or how often they do something like this, like, they know the destruction that's going to be visited on the victims and their family. And when he said that Joyce's body was found near the golf club, I thought of the Curragh Golf Club, and I'm saying, look, Joyce wouldn't be going that direction. Why, you know? But it was actually Kildare Golf Club, of course. You're just across the road from it. And he said in a very gentle voice, "Ray, it's Joyce," because he knew her, he had met her socially. So, and then, you know, all hope drained away.
What happened then? Did you get to see Joyce, or what was the next step
for
you?
No, I didn't see. My brother actually did the identification, which is, you know, a formal requirement. And then Joyce's body wasn't released for about four or five days. That was really dreadful, because my children wanted their mum to look as, you know, as nice as possible, obviously. But, you know, when they had picked a dress, they wanted the mum buried him. But the undertaker came back and said he couldn't use it. And that was because of the injuries and, of course, the pathologist's surgery. And then we tried a second dress. That didn't work either. But then, you know, we were in the funeral home, and my daughter's trying to do their mum's hair and put makeup. But, you know, after the pathologist's examination, like, the stitching is fairly crude, and there was cross stitching behind Joyce's ears, and I was trying to hold her head in such a way that the girls wouldn't notice this. But my poor mother-in-law, who had already lost a husband, you know, he was shot dead in the Middle East, he was in the army, she was just sitting there looking in mute horror at all of this. And she had a very traumatic situation when her husband died. She had just arrived out in Syria and Damascus, and one of the Arab-Israeli wars had started. So she was there with three small children. One of the children was sick. She knew her husband was dead. The city was being bombed by the Israelis. And she was evacuated in a convoy over the mountains into Beirut. And I think the convoy was attacked. But she never mentioned any of that. I only hear that from other sources. All she ever would say to me when we talk about her husband dying was how sorry she felt for her mother-in-law, that a mother should never have to bury a child. And when she arrived at the door that morning after the Gardaí left, and I thought, here we go again. And the poor woman just said to me, two violent deaths in the family. My God, Ray, what did I do? Because we were just a normal family. We were a normal, happy family until that evening that Joyce didn't come home. And then happiness went out the door.
You mentioned that, you know, Joyce's body wasn't released for 4 or 5 days. Is there still a part of your head that's saying, it might not be Joyce, or you don't believe it because you haven't seen it, you've just been told.
Yes, like despite all my experience, you know, I spent 9 years overseas in troubled places with the army. I suppose there's still something in our psyche where you have this silly hope. I remember even at the very last thing there, but just before the coffin was closed, I went down to kiss Joyce for the last time. And her face was wet. Mm. So I thought, tears, you know, she's not dead. You know, I know, absolutely stupid. This is what ran through my mind. But of course, it wasn't. Some people had sprinkled holy water on it, and that's what it was. Yeah, you're right. It's amazing that you will always try to hold on to some little silly bit of hope.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, in your heart and soul, it's hopeless.
That's, I suppose, how it impacted you and how it impacted the family and when you get the news. But then there's also, Ray, the investigation then that has to come afterwards, and you have to find out, well, right, what happened to Joyce? Who did this to Joyce, and what the extent of her injuries were, and maybe trying to establish a timeline of exactly what happened that night. So you have now the information, okay, she went missing, we found her, we've had the funeral. But then I guess the hard work has to start, does it?
Yeah, well, the Gardaí were very efficient and super. And it's just one thing I'd like to say right now, that the Gardaí have a very difficult job to do. But from the moment Joyce went missing and right up to the present day, they have been incredibly compassionate, sensitive and helpful to us. They couldn't do better. So I'd just like to say that. We were told the day after Joyce was buried that the Gardaí came to the house. They had to tidy up all their paperwork, their statements from me and my two younger children. Lisa was 14, David was 15. And then Kenneth O'Reilly was arrested the following morning. But then, as you know, we had to wait 20 months because the trial was deferred for a variety of reasons that made me very, very angry. Mm. But and it was beyond the control of the Gardaí or my control. You, as a victim, you're just like a dumb, mute person. You have no power whatsoever. But the minimum information that did come out, and that was that Kenneth O'Reilly had been seen hanging around the school for the 2 days. It's across the school, across from the shop, 2 days before the murder. He very cold-bloodedly and meticulously planned the crime. And the purpose of the crime was to rape my wife. She was murdered almost as an incidental thing to cover up the crime. He waited down at the hangman's arch there at the bridge. He could see Joyce closing the shop, and he thumbed a lift. Now, he was well known to Joyce. He was a customer in the shop. She had the shop there for 4 years. And so she gave him a lift into, as she thought, she was giving him a lift into Kildare. But when they reached the Curragh, he produced a knife. She was forced to stop, obviously. He stabbed her in the chest. In the right breast or in the left breast, it doesn't matter, I suppose. And then he proceeded to, he drove the car in the plains, an area where you really would have to have done a reconnaissance beforehand, because there was furs and rushes there. And then he raped her, and then he stabbed her again. And like we see, you know, when you go through the forensic report afterwards, I mean, the ferocity of the attack was just horrendous. I mean, I remember after an episode overseas where we were helping local people and we were running short of medical supplies. We were trying to make makeshift bandages out of clothing. And it's not easy to rip clothing. But Joyce's bra was ripped down between the cups. Her panties, leggings, they were ripped. You know, this is very, very hard to do. And there was no knife used for this. This was just brute force. But immediately after committing the crime, Joyce's body was dumped on the plains, just discarded like a piece of rubbish. And he drove back to Milltown using our car, drove the car into the school, where he had already pre-planned by opening the gates, and then proceeded about his business. Now, the first thing he did then was to call into a local man who had questioned why he was hanging around the school. He told this man that he had lost money, but he knocked on his door, cool, calm, said, oh, by the way, I found that money, so don't worry about it. And then he went home, changed, called his girlfriend, went down to the Hangman's Arch, then called a taxi, went into Newbridge, had a Chinese meal, called a taxi again. This all paid for, by the way, with the money stolen from Joyce's shop. And just, you know, it was like throwing a switch. He was a young man with no previous form, by all accounts, a quiet, mannerly fellow. And he behaved like a complete psychopath. I'm just a soldier. I'm not a medic. But my understanding of psychiatric illnesses, a psychopath anyway, that form, it's not an illness. It's actually a personality disorder, and it's not curable. So, look, I have always asked, mainly the only thing I've asked was that if this man is ever paroled, that he be kept out of County Kildare, because I fear for my family, and I fear for... You know, I'd fear for the community too. We're part of this community. Joyce was, she was born in Kildare. She was there as a young child up to when she was 5 or 6 years old. She came back, she was only barely out of her teens when we got married. My children are here. So we're three generations in this community now, of grandchildren here. We've married and we socialise, you know, intermarried with the local community. But I've been fighting the fight to keep this man out of Kildare if he's ever granted parole. But there is a new parole system now, and the Gardaí are asked for their input. But the local people must make their intentions, their fears or anxiety known to the Gardaí. The Gardaí, they can't read people's minds. And, this is going to come up again in 2 years' time. So I would just plead with local people, if you're anxious about it, You should write to the local Garda superintendent in Kildare Town. And that is that's the only way that we can get the information to the parole board that really Kenneth O'Reilly should not be allowed back into this community again.
We'll come back to the parole in a moment, because really that's the reason that we are speaking to you this morning, Ray, is because this is the news that emerged last week, was that he applied for parole, he's had that refused, and he'll now spend at least another 2 years behind bars in prison. But can I just go back to when you find out that the person who committed this crime on your wife was Kenneth O'Reilly? What are you feeling? What are you experiencing? So, like, even when you described there that he went back to his house and he went into Newbridge and had a Chinese meal, all the while your wife is lying in the Curragh. You know, it's when you put those polar opposites together, it's hard to even comprehend. So what are you feeling as a husband?
Well, naturally enough, and I think it's will be part of any person's human nature, that I will be very, very angry with Kenneth O'Reilly for what he did to me and my family, like he destroyed us. My daughter put it fairly well when she was interviewed. She said, when he killed Mum, he didn't just kill Mum, he killed all of us. There was never been remorse or anything expressed by him or his family. It's the whole thing is still unbelievable to us, you know, which is a strange thing to say. But I just feel anger towards him, but incredible sadness for my family, for, you know, the grandchildren that Joyce never got to see, the children and the grandmother they never got to see. And then, of course, there's all the normal events in families, like Christmases, the children's weddings, things like that. No mum present, you know.
Yeah, and those things, come, as you say, your children were 14 and 15, so they had so much more and have experienced so much more over the last number of years, which Joyce hasn't got to see. how have the last number of years been? You know, people say the time heals and all of that. What do you say? Or do you feel as though what you're doing now is, you know, in honour of Joyce and speaking out and standing up for her?
Well, in honour of Joyce, maybe. But the real thing is fear for my family and the extended family, that I do not want Kenneth O'Reilly back in County Kildare. And the Gardaí and the prison service said that County Kildare is the important point to note, because it's a geographical area that is, I would just say, they can control it. If you say something like within 6 miles of Kildare town, well, is that from the traffic lights? Is it from the church? Is it this?
So yeah,
that's it. But my main concern is fear for my family if this fellow returns. And as I said, like, I'm not a medic, but to me, this man displayed psychopathic traits. I would not give him the benefit of the doubt when it comes to my family again. And I think the same should apply to the local community. We're part of this community too. I mean, why should the Milltown, which is a very small area, a small number of houses, it's a village, why should they have to put up with live in fear for the rest of their lives that this man is hanging around? Maybe he will do it again, maybe he won't, who knows? I really don't know, but in 2 years' time, this is going to recur. And I would just ask people in the community to be aware of it. And if you have anxieties, let the Gardaí know. They have a chain of communication into the parole service. They're obliged to send a report through them.
Finally then, Ray, you mentioned that this is going to come up again in 2 years' time. It's already come up in the last few years. You know, this is not something that just comes up once and then goes. You know, you'll have to fight this battle again. So he's been refused parole last week, and he will spend at least another 2 years behind bars, but that's when you'll have to revisit it again.
Yes, we'll have to go again. And look, it was 2017, 2019, then because of COVID there was a break, then there was last year. So this just keeps coming up. And, you know, when I'm asking for the a condition of parole, if it's ever granted to him, to be that he stays out of County Kildare. For some people might say, well, he's done his time. No, he hasn't. We have you get a life sentence, because the death sentence, thankfully, is no longer applicable in this country. But what is terribly wrong with conditions being put on the license? You know, he's released on license. What is wrong with the conditions being put on it, on this release? A person who commits a dreadful crime like this and causes such immense destruction, suffering, misery, they're not doing badly. You know, okay, so he has conditions on his parole, but he is out. The victims, like my wife, they'll never get out of the cemetery, and the victims' families have a life sentence that goes on and on and on.
Well, listen, all I can say, Ray, is thanks so much for coming in to us, regards to you and regards to all the family. I think you have incredible strength and, courage to come out and talk about this. And just to put it into context again for people, and I know when we ran the story last week and we put it up on our website, a lot of people were sending in messages of support to you and the family. And I know you've got a lot of support in the local community in Milltown, and they have rallied around you. So thanks so much for coming in again, and we wish you all the best. That's Ray Quinn, the husband of Joyce Quinn. And again, Kenneth O'Reilly, 22, when he thumbed a lift from Joyce Quinn, who was a 44-year-old shop owner on the outskirts of Kildare town. He was charged and has been in jail since, and will spend another 2 years behind bars. Ray, thanks so much.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie. Kildare KFM.
Okay, thanks again to Ray Quinn for coming in to us here in studio, and a number of messages that are coming in to us. One here saying, great interview from Ray. It's a harrowing story. Fully agree with him. We need to keep Kenneth O'Reilly out of County Kildare. Another one here saying, Ray spoke so well. You can hear the hurt in his voice. And finally, Trish in Robertstown says, my heart breaks for Ray and all the Quinn family after what happened to Joyce. Even though so much time has gone by, it still doesn't make it any easier, I'm sure. Keep those messages coming in to us on 0833 97 97 97. But for the moment, we're going to move on. And I'm joined on the line now by Conor Skehan, former chair of the Housing Agency. He wrote an article in the Irish Independent over the weekend under the headline, "The Three Biggest Threats to the Future of Ireland's Economy and What We Can Do About Them." And the opening line says, "The core institutions of the Irish state are 100 years old, many are threadbare, and most are no longer fit for purpose." Conor Skehan, good morning.
Morning, Ron.
What did you mean by that? And when you talk about the three biggest threats to the future of Ireland's economy, you might expand on those for us.
Sure, yeah. Well, the article was just prompted by remembering, funny enough, Kildare, County Kildare, and how Intel originally set up there a long time ago, and how the amazing county engineer, as it was at the time, John Carrick, had gone in and basically grabbed Intel off County Dublin and persuaded it to come out and set up out in Kildare. And the reason that that struck me was, at that time, individual counties had a lot more autonomy than they do now. Everything is much more centralised and rule-bound now. So it set me to thinking, what would happen if John Carrick were around today and there was another Intel coming in, and would he be able to do what he did then? At the time, John was able to say to them, "We'll have all the water for you, we'll have the sewage for you, we'll have the motorway connection." And none of them existed at the time. And he said, "But by the time you finish building your factory, we'll have built all those things for you." And he did. Amazingly, he did. So that's really what set me to think about it. So the three big problems are not in any particular order, one of which is the extraordinary centralisation that's happened in Ireland over the last 30 years, where more and more decision-making powers have been drawn into central government, more and more ability to act has been drawn into central government. We can see it at its most extreme, I suppose, in things like land use planning, where housing targets and things like that are set for each county now in a centralised way by a national plan. Planning gets a lot of hard knocks. A lot of the time, people don't actually understand what causes the issues. One of the other things, the second of the three, is that, again, going back to the word planning, a lot of people say there's problems with planning in Ireland. The reality is the problem is the legal system. Ireland's legal system is incredibly in need of reform. When we had the Troika in after that awful crash, there were three conditions, and the third condition, the only one that was never touched, was the need to reform the Irish legal system. Irish legal system is widely regarded internationally as being very, very slow, subject to arcane practices, and most of what we call delays in the planning system are actually delays caused by judicial reviews, and they in turn are incredibly slow to move through the planning system. In other countries, they have a thing called an administrative court. And when there's a problem with a decision, they take the decision in and they look at the procedures that were followed and say, were the procedures correct or not? And they move those through incredibly quickly without opening the box, so to speak, of what the decision itself was. And originally in Ireland, that's what judicial reviews used to mean. They had a thing called curial deference, where judges didn't make statements about birds or fish or groundwater. They just said this decision was or was not in accordance with procedure. We're one of the few countries in Europe that doesn't actually have an administrative court. So that could free a huge amount up incredibly quickly. And then the last thing is that we burden ourselves with a very purist interpretation of an awful lot of requirements, legal requirements that come from EU directives about things like water management, groundwater management, habitat management, and things like that. And these are incredibly important protections for the environment to have. But every other country in Europe that has them make sure that when they're implemented with oversight, so to speak, and the oversight is to make sure that the other half of the economy isn't forgotten, so that you have to have both protection of the environment and protection of people as well, to make sure that people and their lives can continue as they've always done.
And just to elaborate on them, Conor, sorry, just to come in there, this is really, and you outlined this in your piece, about future proofing, and it's for the next generation here in this country, because a lot of the what you've mentioned there have been in place for quite some time. So now is, you feel, the time to change things up a little bit.
Yeah, and most of the issues are to do with structures, governance, administration. I've no quibble with any of the law or any of the standards or any of the protections that are in place for the environment. It's how we administer them, how we what kind of oversight we have. And we're not great at being innovative in terms of administration. When we do choose to do it, we can do an amazing job. I mean, many of you, many of our older listeners will remember that the revenue commissioners in Ireland used to be an absolute dog to deal with. And they went and reinvented themselves, and they're probably one of the most efficient and user-friendly government institutions that's out there now. They're extraordinarily helpful and good, and it's an indication of what you can do when institutions decide to take themselves on and dust themselves down. And I think that's available to us across a lot of other fields. One of the main things it needs is to have oversight. So the local authority system in Ireland has a thing in place called a director of services. So the planning section, for instance, is run by planners, but it's overseen by a director of services to make sure it's delivered promptly and efficiently and effectively. And Kildare would be one of the best counties in Ireland for that. They're really, really good at it. But we need that moving back up the line so that mainline departments that oversee all these things, they have to have somebody with oversight to make sure that we're not being pleasers who's all the time trying to do things that make us look good in front of Europe. We've got to make sure that we're prepared to make sure there's water in our rivers to supply our towns and our sewage treatment plants and our industries as well.
Okay, finally then, Conor, as I mentioned, you're the former chair of the Housing Agency. What do you make, really, of the housing situation here in Ireland and how it's impacting people? So we've talked about maybe the economy and businesses, but what about housing and people here in this country?
I think there's two issues, one of which is that we're an island off an island at the edge of Europe, and we tend to get lost in thinking that whatever's happening to us is we're the only people in the world it's happening to. Any of your listeners who've got a smartphone or a laptop in front of them can Google the word housing crisis and stick the name of their favourite country in, preferably in English speaking, once you can understand the headlines, and you'll see housing crisis New Zealand, housing crisis Canada, housing crisis United States, housing crisis Britain. It's an issue that's happening all over the world, and it's being driven by the extent to which investors have come into the housing market in the last 20 years. So that's the short answer to that. We are not alone. This is a problem everywhere. What's kind of unique about Ireland is the extent to which there's a whole group of people who are activists in the housing sector who are grabbing the mic all the time talking about it and doing huge harm as they do it. And so, for instance, all of this talk about the eviction ban is being driven by people who are housing activists and advocates. But all they're doing is they're driving landlords out of the market. The vast majority of landlords, as they're called in Ireland, aren't people with big moustaches riding a horse. They're the couple living next door who have a kid they're putting through college, or an elderly person for whom it's their pension. And they're driving them out. They've driven 50,000 landlords out of the market in the last 5 years. I was in a taxi yesterday coming back in from Kildare, and the driver was telling me that he and his wife had two houses. They both had bought houses when they were young. They held on to them to rent. And he said, the best thing we've ever done is we got rid of both those houses as rental properties in the last 12 months. He said, we just don't know ourselves. We're so happy. And these people who are these activists calling for all this are unintentionally pouring more fuel on the fire, driving out landlords, having less rental property available. And of course, then there's shortages of rental housing when there's fewer landlords.
All right. On that note, Conor Skehan, former chair of the Housing Agency, on that issue in terms of housing, but also the three biggest threats to the future of Ireland's economy and what we can do about them. You can read more in the Irish Independent online. Thanks for joining us, Conor, and good morning. Now, some of the messages that are coming in to us. Gemma Dunn says, just listening to Ray Quinn, such a sad interview, but a great interview. I think Kenneth O'Reilly should never see the light of day again. Much admiration for Ray Quinn. Totally agree on his thoughts on keeping Kenneth O'Reilly out of Kildare. That comes in from Jill from Carlo. Another one over on the text line. Tom in Kildare says, fully supporting Ray and the family. Another one, heartbreaking listening to Ray Quinn, but I agree with him on all his sentiments. And another one in here saying we fully support Ray Quinn in relation to what he said in that interview. Thanks for getting in touch.